Today on the 21st show, this January marked 5 years since a mob attacked the U.S. Capitol building. Scholar Laura K. Field spent years researching what led up to January 6th and the intellectuals who've aligned themselves with President Trump.
It's always hard to untangle what is just a posture and what is real when you're reading some of these documents, but I think some of these people were really convinced that the Democrats didn't have any legitimate voters.
Field's book is Furious Minds, The Making of the MAGA New Right. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. Airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WNIJ in Rockford-DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. A little more than 5 years ago, a mob stormed the United States Capitol. They broke windows, they beat police officers, they sent lawmakers running for their lives. In the years since, we've heard congressional investigations, criminal prosecutions, and a whole lot of debate about what that day meant for American democracy. My guest today has been studying what led up to January 6th. Not just the rally and the riot, but the ideas behind Stop the Steal in particular and the MAGA movement in general. Laura K. Field is a political theorist who spent years in conservative academic circles before writing about how that universe has evolved under President Trump. Her recent book is Furious Minds, The Making of the MAGA New Right. Field has a PhD in government from the University of Texas at Austin, where she studied political theory and public law. She's had university faculty positions in the past and is presently a senior advisor for the Illiberalism Studies program at George Washington University and a non-resident fellow with the Brookings Institution. I spoke with Field back in January, 5 years to the day after the Capitol attack. We'll be revisiting that conversation for the hour today. Because our program's on tape, no calls, but you can always let us know what you think. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org. All right, Laura, I want to start with how you came to be interested in the intellectual world around MAGA, because, you know, sometimes people question whether that's even like the proper framing. Is there really intellect behind what's happening there?
Yeah, thank you. I'm sort of surprised myself to have written this book and to have sort of become the person who was following this so closely. But the short version of it is that, as you mentioned, I studied with conservative intellectuals in the sort of Straussian mold. I fell in love with political philosophy as an undergraduate student and then studied at the University of Texas with these Straussians who are followers of Leo Strauss, who's a political philosopher who had a lot of influence in the last century.
I was going to say, what is that elevator pitch version of what it means to be a Straussian?
I mean, there's a kind of attention to close reading and a sort of careful close reading of canonical books of political philosophy. And the shorthand is that sort of Strauss uncovered the tradition of esoteric writing, which he believed, and I'm persuaded, was practiced by many philosophers as a way of sort of avoiding persecution or of not being dogmatic. So there's this rich tradition there, and it's been sort of controversial in American politics because many of his students have had a lot of influence. But anyway, I studied in those circles, and I was interested in philosophy and reading the great books, but I was never much of a conservative myself at all. And then in 2016, when Trump won, I shortly thereafter discovered that some partisans of Strauss from what we call the West Coast Straussian School in California were some of the very first to defend Trump from an intellectual perspective. And the most famous example of this is the Flight 93 election by Michael Anton. And so I started watching that really closely. I was pretty shocked to read that essay. And so I started following the developments on the right in the intellectual spheres and watching the coalescence of what I now call the MAGA New Right. And I was at a point where I just wanted to write more and for public audiences. So I sort of used that as my moment to do more what we academics call public facing writing. And I've been I didn't expect to be writing this book, to be honest, I sort of thought after January 6th that these people would take the off ramp, you know, that they would say, okay, this has gone sour, this was not a good idea, the whole Trump thing, you know, and obviously that's not what happened. And so, you know, around 2022 it became clear that this intellectual movement would continue to really matter in the future. And so that's when I started writing the book.
Yeah, I want to come back to some of the ideas you touched on there with the off-ramp, Michael Anton. But, you know, getting back to basics here, I mean, Donald Trump is known for many things, but being a, you know, sort of deep philosopher is not among them, right? I've heard you describe him as more of a, I think the term was instinctive thinker or instinctive political figure. What does it mean to talk about a Trump or MAGA intellectual movement?
Yeah, I mean, I think it sounds like a bit of an oxymoron to people, and I understand that. I think my view of it is that Trump, I think that's right. He's more of an instinctive person, an intuitive politician, we might say. And he's almost an anti-intellectual. I think that's all fair. He's not the one reading these writers that I'm talking about, but I think he sort of has actually given cover or sort of camouflage to this intellectual movement. And what it is, it's a bunch of people who liked what Trump stood for, who recognized how it connected with the threads of conservatism that they thought had been lost in the what I would call the old Republican establishment. And so they started to kind of articulate that, drawing on these older resources and legitimating it, right? Just first by articulating it, and then partly by making it sound more sophisticated, and also just, you know, providing real arguments for it, defenses, complicated, you know, world historical claims about why this matters and why it's important, and basically how Trump should be used. Sometimes they're quite explicit about this as a vehicle for other conservative concerns or purposes. And so the book chronicles the coalescence of this movement, how these different sort of formerly fringe people came together in the first Trump administration and did certainly gain some power. And then after January 6th, they were involved in January 6th, and we could talk about that. But then after January 6th, they really consolidated power within the Republican Party. And so the book covers 2016 through 2024. And it's really a story of deep ideological radicalization, on the part of a whole lot of smart people who I don't agree with very often. I do think they make some good arguments, but are certainly sophisticated and intelligent and drawing on, you know, real sources from the American tradition and from thinkers around the world. So I think it's a mistake to think that just because someone is, you know, really, you know, bigoted or prejudiced or even fascist, right? That there isn't some intelligence at work there. I
Yeah,
think
I've heard
that's
you
really
say
my
something
view.
like you wouldn't want to debate them on certain topics, right? Necessarily.
That's
Just
true. I
in
mean,
the
you
sense of
know,
like their
people,
depth of
yeah.
knowledge. Yeah.
That's right. I mean, I think that we tend to, you know, in academia, people get very specialized very quickly. And that's true for me. That's true for everyone I know in academia. And it's certainly true for these guys. And they're almost all guys, right? But, you know, some of them have really a depth of knowledge that is impressive in one domain or another. And so some of them I don't feel that way about. Often I think that they are manipulating, you know, the history, but sometimes there's a real depth there, and there's a real sort of facility with all kinds of parts of history or philosophy that I'm not very familiar with. So yeah, I think it's a big mistake to think that, I mean, as I've already said, they are very smart. Some of them are very well educated, and so it's I think there's we're very as liberals, and I'm a good liberal, we're way too quick to say, oh, they're just idiots, because that's really not what's going on here. And I think that in a way we've seen so much over the last, I mean, they keep surprising me. But they've had success after success. It's been really astonishing. And so it's time now, I think, to just not be thinking so superficially about who these people are.
Okay, you mentioned the Michael Anton essay, 2016, the Flight 93 election. Of course, that is a reference to the passengers who sort of realized what was happening on 9/11 and decided to sort of take history into their own hands and crash the jet, as far as we know, on that day. How does he relate that to the 2016 election, for those who haven't read it?
Yeah, so he takes that, act of heroism, and he uses it rhetorically to say that a Hillary victory would be allowing them to crash the plane, and so voting for Trump is more like being the hero in the story, where you take your chances, you don't know what's going to happen. But he says something like, with Hillary, death is certain, and he means by that, you know, the end, it's the end of America if Hillary Clinton wins this election, but with Trump we can sort of roll the dice and take our chances.
He served in the first Trump administration and then was back in this one. What does it mean that these ideas have moved from, you know, sort of think tanks and opinion pieces into actual positions of power?
Well, I mean, I think it's a staggering, it's staggering in that it demonstrates their real success, which I think, you know, in 2016, when I first read that essay or even heard about it, I was, you know, everybody I know was kind of laughing at it. They, you know, everyone was like, oh, we know this, this is just preposterous. And then he got into the administration, and he didn't last that long in the first administration, but he was brought back in for this one and is apparently the main author for this new national security strategy. And so, I mean, I think it's a real sign of how radicalized the new administration is. When you think about the MAGA New Right, which is again this sort of intellectual faction, it's not all of MAGA, it's sort of one narrow part of it, but a very influential part. And their successes, you know, I think it's, I continue to be, as I said, I continue to be surprised. I was surprised by the selection of Vance for the vice presidency. That was a real success on their part. The victory, of course, of Trump and Vance was a real victory. The Doge thing with Elon Musk, you know, doing everything he's done, that was really surprising to me. And so was the authorship of the national security strategy. So I think it sort of shows just how much of an effect even a small group of people can have. And what they've really done is use a lot of culture war tactics to sort of just force their way into the political scene in Washington, D.C.
I think one other, and I want to get to January 6th in a moment here, but one other sort of thread throughout the book is the Claremont Institute. For mm-hmm. people who aren't familiar with that, what is it? How did it start? What were its origins?
So the Claremont Institute is this pretty small think tank that has its headquarters in Claremont, or just outside of Claremont, California, and I think they're not even located there anymore, but they were for many years. They were founded in 1979 by several students of Harry V. Jaffa, who was a prominent Lincoln scholar and intellectual historian who was a real supporter of sort of declarationism and this idea that the most important thing about American history are the principles of the American founding, as found in the Declaration of Independence in particular. And so he wrote this book that was all about Lincoln's moral principle as that sort of stood up against the Confederate principles and majoritarianism of Stephen Douglas. So that's a long, long story, but basically he really was a sort of stand-up thinker who stood for, in many ways anyway, who stood for the principles of the Declaration. And the Claremont Institute is devoted to restoring those principles of the original American founding to American politics, but they've sort of strayed from that original founding message. And so Michael Anton is a senior fellow with the Claremont Institute, and the Claremont Institute has been really at the foreground of defending Trump. Thanks, beginning with Michael Anton and then sort of flowing out from there. And they were pivotal in some of the leaders there were pivotal in the lead up to January 6th. But I mean, I sort of track the story of the transformation of the Claremont Institute. They're different from other think tanks in that they really focus on not so much on policy. You know, they're not very wonkish. They're really about culture warring and defending these principles of the founding, but only as only they could possibly understand it. So there's this very sort of strident, I'd say dogmatic way of understanding the American founding, and they really think they're the ones who have sort of true access to what that means, and anybody who disagrees with them is wrong. So it's a pretty narrow way of understanding American history.
Yeah, and they're kind of like a Waldo figure in the book, right? People give, if they're not affiliates or you know, senior fellows or whatever the terms are, you know, they're giving speeches at events, and it's really threaded through.
And they've been really prominent in the new administration. I think Politico just published a piece that says, you know, there are at least 70 former Claremont fellows in the new administration. And they're also very close with J.D. Vance, and so far as they've given him honors, he's spoken at their events, and so they're real sort of movers and players now in Washington.
Yeah. And maybe we can talk later then about what that means for the idea of how MAGA exists after Trump, right? One way or another, mm-hmm. he will exit the scene, and you mm-hmm. know what happens to that movement in the future. All right, let me reintroduce our conversation. We're listening back to my January interview with Laura Field about her book, Furious Minds, The Making of the MAGA New Right. This year marks 5 years since the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. When we come back, we're going to be talking about that. Again, our program's on tape today, so no calls, but you can always let us know what you think by emailing us. Our address is talk@21stshow.org. You can also join our texting group where we get your thoughts and questions on what we're going to be talking about, usually ahead of time. As we'll hear later in the hour, we often share those comments on the air. You can join that by texting the word TALK, T-A-L-K, to 217-803-0730. Again, text the word TALK to 217-803-0730. More to come after a break. This is The 21st Show. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. My guest today is Laura Field, author of the book Furious Minds, The Making of the MAGA New Right. She's a senior advisor for the Illiberalism Studies Program at George Washington University and also a non-resident fellow with the Brookings Institution. We're revisiting our conversation with her from January, 5 years to the day after the attack on the U.S. Capitol building. We asked members of our texting group about this. In particular, where were you on January 6th, and how did you make sense of what you were watching? Karen in Simpson said, I happened to turn on the TV that morning, which I rarely did, to watch the vote certification. I called my husband into the room and we watched, dumbstruck, horrified, and sickened as the rioters overtook the Capitol. It felt like we were watching a violent revolution in a third world country far across the globe, not our own. I still don't understand how elected representatives in this country find this event acceptable and am beyond disturbed by the ongoing move to erase what happened from history. Thanks for that message, Karen. Again, you can join our texting group by sending the word TALK to 217-803-0730. 217-803-0730. That said, our program today is on tape, so we're not taking new calls or text messages live, but you can always let us know what you thought after the fact. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org. All right, Laura, one of the things I want to accomplish in our conversation is to help people understand that January 6th didn't just happen. It grew out of ideas that had been seeded for months. So where did the first claims about a stolen election and a Biden coup come from, even before the election happened?
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of people, I think, parroting those arguments and rehearsing this story about a rigged election, especially, I mean, it all started with Donald Trump, I believe, right? I mean, so he had been sort of beating that drum for quite a long time. But I really try to shine a light on how active the leaders of the Claremont Institute were during that period, and how deeply conspiratorial they were. And that started in the summer of 2020 and continued all the way up to the lead up to the election in these various publications that they ran on their website in the lead up to the election. And then over the course of the days of the election and the counting, they weren't just saying that it was possible that there had been some fraud or that there might be something questionable or complicated about the election results. They were saying, I think the first big article like this came out in September of 2020, and they were saying that prepare for the coup, right? That there would be that the Democrats were preparing to steal the election. And then over the course of the following months, they got more and more extreme in their claims. And, you know, in the days leading up to the election, were very determined that there was a coup underway. And so they were publishing these articles that were sort of, some of which were a rehash of some more conspiratorial websites than even their own. And so that was one part of the story that I really try to disclose in that, in the central chapter of my book.
Yeah, you write that in the lead up to 2020, to the election, quote, "it became clear that for some thinkers on the right, there was no world in which a Democratic win could be legitimate," end quote. Mm-hmm. Talk about mm-hmm. that. How does that work?
Well, I mean, there were a lot of people worried about the 2020 election, right? Which is sort of some of the background here. I don't think probably listeners here will remember this, right? Where we were in the middle of the pandemic, or in the very beginnings of the pandemic, really. Still, there had been this very sort of upsetting summer with protests and all this, with the death of George Floyd and the protests and violence. And so people were uneasy, I think, leading up to that election. And because of the pandemic, many of states had changed their laws to allow for more mail-in voting. And there were sort of organizations trying to game out different election scenarios, partly because Trump kept talking about illegitimate elections, right? I mean, so they were trying to game out, so what would happen in the case of different kinds of scenarios. And so the right, the Claremont Institute and the Texas Institute for Public Policy, which at the time was under the leadership of Kevin Roberts, who is now the president of the Heritage Foundation, they got together and did their own version of this kind of game out scenario. But I mean, what became clear in the course of my research as I was looking at these different memos that had been written and these publications that the Claremont Institute had been publishing, you know, they couldn't allow themselves to think that Democrats could possibly win the election legitimately. I mean, I think it's always hard to untangle what is just a posture and what is real when you're reading some of these documents. But I think some of these people were really convinced that the Democrats didn't have any legitimate voters. Like it's this, the kind of mania that you see taking over, such that they're almost sort of presuming that the Democrats couldn't win and then building out their theory to support that view and sort of like kind of post hoc rationalizing this imminent disaster. It's very strange reading. And so, and maybe it's all just sort of lying propaganda, but at some point, I mean, my hunch is that they sort of believed this, that they sort of have this deeper outlook that frames democratic thought and just sort of ordinary democratic voters as somehow so deeply misguided about the character of the country that there's nothing legitimate there.
It's interesting because you say that, and I feel like I hear a version of this sometimes from people I know on the left side of American politics who will say things like, "I can't imagine how anyone could vote for that guy," or "look at what he did, mm-hmm. how could anyone vote for him?" And yet mm-hmm. the outcome of that is not, well, then let's storm the Capitol because it can't possibly be legitimate. It's months mm-hmm. or now a year of hand-wringing over how did we go wrong, you know, that sort of thing you hear from Democrats.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things I think about is how this, I talk about how the January 6th riots and sort of the insurrection has become a kind of lost cause myth on the right. But one thing that's interesting is that, you know, January Six happened in 2021. And then in this last election, Trump won the election, and nobody was making any arguments in the lead up to that election. I think probably because the people could see that Democrats were in a pretty weak position. Nobody was making arguments like this. Nobody was concerned really about the legitimacy of the election. And that includes Republicans who have been lying, and saying for many, many years now that January 6th, that the 2020 election was false. And we didn't hear any of those rumblings really this time around. And so I think that has even maybe it's sort of subtle and but there's a kind of defanging there of the whole January 6th narrative insofar as people have accepted very clearly the legitimacy of the most recent election.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Let's talk about John Eastman. Who's John Eastman?
So John Eastman is the one of the founding the founder or he's the founding director, I think, of the Claremont Institute Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence. So this is, a person who has a JD, I believe, from the University of Chicago and has clerked for Clarence Thomas and Justice Luttig quite a long time ago. So someone who has had very prominent positions in the conservative legal movement. And then who helped found this center at the Claremont Institute. And so he's been there for many, many years. And in the lead up to January 6th, he was asked by somebody in the Trump administration to come up with some rationales and some memos to help them contest the election results. And so he published these two famous coup, what we call the coup memos, which were efforts to persuade Vice President Pence that he did not need to certify the election results on January 6th, and that in fact he had a duty to not certify them, so that according to some arguments in these memos, the American public and Congress could get to the bottom of what had actually happened. Now, these memos, the basic problem here was that these memos, there were a lot of problems with these memos, and I try to sort of dis I sort of show and map out in the book, why these were so fanciful and why many conservative legal scholars agree. But the real problem is that they were based on this assumption that there were these legitimate alternate slates of electors in seven states, seven red states, that meant that those electoral votes shouldn't be counted. And that was just a bald-faced lie. There were no such alternate slates. And that sort of with that piece of his argument unraveling, there was really no legitimacy to the memos at all. So anyway, he did this. Pence saw through this, right? He had a very scathing note to the president saying, "I want no part of this. I don't have this legal right." He had his lawyers check it out and said, "I want no part in this," and he suffered the consequences. But John Eastman was responsible for a lot of that. He stepped up to help the president with these just these fantastical legal memos. And even he was also present on January 6th speaking to rally goers before the president did in the Ellipse that day.
Yeah, you have him standing right next to America's mayor as they're
Yeah,
talking to the
you can go
crowd.
on YouTube and watch his speech. It's pretty astounding.
Yeah. You quote an email from Greg Jacob, who is one of, at the time, Vice President Pence's lawyers, describing Eastman's advice as a, quote, serpent in the ear of the president. And he writes, it was gravely, gravely irresponsible to entice the president with an academic theory that had no legal viability. What do you make of this idea that Trump was enticed into January 6th by his advisors?
That's a great question. I mean, it might have been more the reverse, right? Where John Eastman was enticed by the president to write these bizarre memos. I don't know. I mean, I think that power being what it is, someone like Trump is going to find people to make the arguments he wants to hear. And so that's kind of the role that Eastman played. But it also was a choice that Eastman made. And he came up with some arguments that, to I think most reasonable people or who anyone to most certainly most legal scholars, they just sound like absolute sophistry, right? You're taking a few, maybe a few points in the law that have some uncertainty, you know, that maybe you could fudge a little bit and make sound a certain way, but he's really just sort of overhauling the deeper principles that inform the constitutional order. And not to mention, as I keep sort of trying to hammer down in that chapter, you know, there were no alternate slates of electors. Like, that was just total fabrication. And so he made the choice to do that, you know, and without that kind of legal argument, I'm not saying that January 6th wouldn't have happened. I'm not trying to draw a direct causal connection between what Eastman did and January 6th, but I imagine that, you know, Trump saw those memos and people in Trump's circle saw those memos and they thought, well, look here, this is a reputable man. This is somebody who's got deep ties across a conservative legal movement, who is, you know, well respected and at the Claremont Institute. And he's saying that we really have a shot here. Not only do we have a shot, we would be derelict in duty. We are failing the American people if we don't do this. So, you know, that's a pretty powerful thing. And I think that there are a lot of people in Washington, D.C. who need that kind of justification to act a certain way. They need to know, they need to think they're on the right side of things.
Yeah. We have Paul calling from Urbana on line one. Paul, thanks for calling in.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear this stuff about the Claremont Institute and all this. I've never heard it, and I did look into this quite a bit. I'm preoccupied with the people you might call the foot soldiers, the people that are on the ground, the Proud Boys, Allie Alexander, mm-hmm. who's founded the Stop the Steal movement. I forget where that was based, but it just seems to me that that kind of alienation, the liberal elites idea, I think this right-wing populism is left open because of the fecklessness of the Democrats. I'm sorry to have to say that again, but the alienation is real. There are conspiracies that we don't hear about, and QAnon, et cetera, had this fertile ground to act in. And so that dimension, I think, is important. And I also wanted to know if you chronicled like sort of the interaction between your intellectual theorists of the uprising and these people on the ground. Is that clear?
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Appreciate the question. How does this, how do these intellectual arguments connect to the mob, basically?
Yeah, I mean, that's such a good question. And I will say I'm very sympathetic to this idea that the fecklessness of the Democrats has contributed in all kinds of ways to what we are seeing in our politics today. So, I mean, the book is about the right, and I'm a registered Democrat, and I'm pretty sympathetic to, you know, what Democrats stand for. But I think that there's been some real failures there. So I appreciate that. The book covers quite a bit, but it doesn't cover what you call the foot soldiers, just because I had to kind of limit myself. But it does cover, so I sort of limited myself to, honestly, people with PhDs or who just are otherwise really important to sort of the intellectual movement. So, you know, this is sort of taking up the intellectuals. Like, in the past, it was Frank Meyer, William F. Buckley. Now we've got these Claremont guys and the Heritage Foundation. So it's kind of limited in that way. But I think if you do look at the book, you'll be able to see some of these connections. They kind of come up intuitively. And what I do cover is what I call the hard right, which there are some of these figures who they're kind of like pseudo-Nietzschean fascist types who are all over the manosphere. People like Bronze Age Pervert or Curtis Yarvin or Raw Egg Nationalist, who you certainly see on Twitter interacting with those other groups. But I'm just not at all an expert on the Proud Boys and these sort of old right, these far right vigilante groups. And so they're just not really a big focus of my book.
All right, let me reintroduce our conversation. We're listening back to my interview with Laura Field. Her book is Furious Minds, The Making of the MAGA New Right. I originally spoke with her in January, 5 years to the day after the attack on the Capitol building. More to come after a break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening back to my January conversation with Laura Field about her book, Furious Minds, The Making of the MAGA New Right. This year marks 5 years since the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol building, and in fact, that's when I spoke with Field earlier this year. At the time, we asked listeners in our texting group to remember where they were on January 6th. We heard from Tony in Champaign, who said, J6 reminded me of substitute teaching when some of the kids in the back of the class got too bored. Some people are always barely holding it together, and I'm surprised they don't disrupt things more often. Most of what we can do to address their growing presence is not something we're good at, so I fear for the future. Mike in Lawson told us, I'm not sure what bothers me more, the January 6th attack or the growth of the denial which is spread through so many elected officials on the Republican side to the point where it's now a litmus test. Publicly deny reality or leave the party. One more message from Ann in Urbana. I was driving to our church on January 6th, 2021 to record a sermon. I was listening to the report of the rioters breaking into the Capitol as I pulled into the parking lot. My sermon was titled A Light Shining in a Dark Place, and it was about hope. It started with, we're in the middle of history right now, one of those momentous times that will be the stuff of student term papers, fodder for probably hundreds of books and at least 10 movies. Maybe you wish, like I sometimes do, that we were not living in these times. But here we are. Anne goes on to say, I had no idea that the riot would be the backdrop for those words. I'm still struck by their appropriateness. Tony, Mike, Anne, thanks so much for your messages. Everyone else out there, if you want to join our texting group, send the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Our program's on tape today, so no calls, but you will be notified about future conversations and future opportunities to contribute just like that if you send the word TALK, T-A-L-K, to 217-803-0730. Laura, it really has become a loyalty test, right? Believe the false story that the election was stolen from Donald Trump, or, you know, the more straightforward reality that people were unhappy after a year of COVID and just voted for the other guy, as happens so often in American politics. Talk about how this became, you know, the shibboleth on the right.
Yeah, I mean, I think for a while it seemed like that wasn't going to happen. You know, that that there would be some accountability, that the party, you know, Mitch McConnell, I don't think has ever passed that litmus test. And there are a few others who, Mike Pence either, right? And so you have some people who refuse, but they are, you know, of diminishing importance. And anybody who's important in the GOP right now has to pass that test of loyalty to Trump, even though I think it's pretty half-hearted in many, many instances. I think of it, people began comparing it to the lost cause of the Confederacy quite early on. And I think that's right, because there's something kind of, fishy about it. And it's kind of this latent claim that, oh, we're so misunderstood, we're the true heroes. But I think around that, there's just a lot of people who know that that's just not true, right? That it's this kind of lie and fudge. And so it's a very strange thing in our politics. And I wonder, you know, I wonder if the lie and the lost cause loyalty test will kind of diminish as Trump's, well, depending on the next 3 years, I guess.
That, this lost cause framing really bums me out because, you know, General Grant and the Union Army, the American Army, put down the rebellion 161 years ago, and we're still fighting mm-hmm. about that now.
Yeah, it's not just that it sort of has echoes of that that myth, right? It's that it resonates in deep ways with the causes of those, right? With the actual Confederate cause, I think. So there's something really, really ugly about all of it.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I was thinking about in reading this chapter in particular is When talking about Republicans, from President Trump to members of Congress, I often hear people say they know better, right? Whether it's about the 2020 election. I think you just mentioned yourself, mm-hmm. sort of half-hearted people half-heartedly buying into it. But yesterday we had a guest who said, when I talk to Republicans, they tell me they understand climate change is a problem, but they don't feel like they can vote that way. And there's this assumption that people on the right don't really believe what they're saying. How do you think about that question of sincerity versus cynicism?
That's a great question. I think that a lot of the people I write about, because I'm talking about the intellectual core of the movement, I do think that they are very sincere, and frankly, they are fanatical. These are kind of, I try to chart how I think the Republican leadership has gone, has become sort of governed or run by real ideologues who have all kinds of ideological pre-commitments that are quite misguided and sort of delusional in some instances, but nevertheless, they truly believe in. I don't think that's true very broadly. I think it's quite a narrow group who feels that way. They've had some real results, as I've listed before, you know, J.D. Vance, the Doge stuff, the taking over the leadership at some of these key institutions like the Heritage Foundation. And they have a lot of sort of cultural cachet in Washington, D.C. with the young staffers and stuff. That much I'm quite persuaded by. But I think that those people who say this stuff about the lawmakers and the people in who actually hold political office and how they are only half-hearted about it or quite skeptical, I think that those things are true. I think that a lot of the actual people are really under the thumb of Trump's movement because they know that they need those votes and they need that base right now. And so I think that's real. I find it, you know, it's cynical. I'm not sure I admire those people who are not willing to speak out against what's happened, but I sort of understand where they're coming from. And I think that what I was trying to do in the book is show really how extreme some of these ideological leaders are, partly because I think they're far away from ordinary voters, especially even including many MAGA voters who are not nearly so radicalized, who might be sort of interested in some of these ideas or curious about it or have real disagreements, obviously, with the Democrats and are displeased with politics or alienated in the way one of those callers described earlier. But I think that most Americans are not nearly as radicalized as some of these leaders of the Trump movement are. And I think it's really important to keep sight of that.
We've got Doug calling from Naperville. Doug, thanks for calling in.
Yeah, thank you. Laura, I'd be grateful for your thoughts on Mitch McConnell. Is just reading Heather Scott Richardson this morning in her daily writings, the historian. Mitch McConnell makes the statements on the Senate floor on the evening of January 6th, and then says he would not vote for impeachment, be confident it will be handled through the legal American jurisprudence. Just the quandary of Mitch McConnell, for me, be grateful for your thoughts.
Thank you, Doug.
I think it is a quandary. I mean, I puzzle through people like Mitch McConnell and others who seem to constantly be aware of some of these big constitutional problems and the massive failures of their party to rein in not just the president, but, you know, the whole movement. And yet they're so mealy-mouthed when it comes to actually saying anything or doing much about any of it. And they've shown so little leadership. And I don't really understand what that is. I often think they're calculating that this too shall pass, that somehow America is strong enough to withstand all of these, what I see as real crises of legitimacy, both at home and abroad, right? I think that America's standing is really being affected by this, let alone all the people who are being really harmed by what's happening. So I don't have a good answer for you. I mean, I sort of contend with personalities like that throughout the book, trying to puzzle it out. But to me, it's still a mystery and kind of a real form of cowardice.
You describe, getting back to this idea of the lost cause, right? And this idea of the Flight 93 election and all this kind of coming, these threads coming together. You write in the book that once you begin understanding our national politics as a matter of emergencies, corruption, and lies reparable only by figures of exceptional heroism, There is no returning to a politics of the everyday, of democratic choice and representation, and of disagreement, contestation, and compromise. What does it mean for people on the right to feel that we are in a perpetual state of emergency?
Yeah, I mean, I think this has to do with, and at least with respect to the Claremont Institute people, it has to do with their conception of the American Constitution. And what they have convinced themselves of is that, you know, you can read a book by Charles Kessler called The Crisis of the Two Constitutions. And there's the Progressive Constitution, which is bad and sort of changeable. And then there's the original Founders Constitution. And the basic take on the part of the Claremont people is that we have strayed so far from that original constitution that what we need is a counter-revolution. That things have gotten so bad and just so apocalyptically, we're in such a state of failure that it warrants Donald Trump, Elon Musk, all of the things that we're seeing happening, or the kidnapping of Maduro, right? And so all of these things are justified by this supposed crisis, and so that makes it, you have to wonder, well, when will they be done? When will things, first of all, are things that bad? I mean, they might be pretty bad on Twitter, but if you go out to your grocery store, right, in any part of the country, it's not an apocalypse out there, right? There are real problems, but you know, you can still speak to your neighbors in most cases, even across the political spectrum. So
yeah, JVL at the Bulwark likes to point out the you know, the MAGA boat parades of people in their like $100,000 fishing boats or whatever.
Right. And the MAGA folks are doing okay, but I mean, I think what it becomes is this kind of cycle where, I mean, are they helping, right, with this divisive apocalyptic rhetoric and their actions? Are they helping, you know, bring things back to a less crisis-ridden condition? I mean, it doesn't seem so. So at what point are they sort of creating the crises and just so that they can respond to them? I think it's psychologically very interesting, but it's very dangerous for the country.
We talked at the beginning of this idea of there might have been an off-ramp after January 6th. And I went back and I listened to, or I should say, I read the transcript of Mitch McConnell's comments, you know, after the impeachment vote, when he said President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of the day. No question about it. And yet here we are. And other people have said, well, you know, Trump is a unique figure. He was a reality TV star. Most Americans, as you say, they're not steeped in these ideas of, you know, a Catholic royalty or whatever, you know, some of these people would want. This is not what most Americans want. But what, you know, where do you see the potential futures of this? And I should say we only have a couple minutes left in our time together. But where do you see the potential futures of this as Trump will exit the stage one way or another in the next few years?
I'll say, I think that something about the MAGA movement is here to stay, right? Insofar as it has transformed the Republican Party. I think J.D. Vance is everybody's sort of golden boy on the new right. So he's the immediate sort of default person to take up the torch of Trumpism. I think he's going to have a very, very hard time for some of the reasons you just mentioned. I mean, the party itself is having a lot of internal problems right now. The president is very unpopular. And Vance doesn't have some of those unique qualities that Trump does. So, I mean, he's very smart. I don't think we should underestimate him. But, you know, part of my work has been to show how extreme some of this stuff is. And J.D. Vance is absolutely no exception. He's the culmination of all the different factions that I write about. And he is, I think, absolutely shameless in his ideological fervor.
Well, the book is called Furious Minds, The Making of the MAGA New Right. The author is Laura K. Field. It's been on a lot of year-end best books list. It's a really enjoyable read. And it's a personal story, too, in a lot of ways. So, Laura, thank you so much for taking the time, especially on this important milestone day in American history, to talk with us about it. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure.
We originally spoke with Laura on the program back in January, 5 years to the day since the attacks on the U.S. Capitol. That's it for us today. If you have thoughts on today's conversation or really anything we've talked about or something you'd like us to talk about, you can get in touch with us through our website, 21stshow.org. We've got our voicemail line there and our email address, which is talk@21stshow.org. We've got past segments there, and you can find links to subscribe to our podcast. Or just look us up on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you listen. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Colson Khan. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.